In this video, we're going to cover opposition to capitalism as dependent on bad epistemology from chapter 11 of Leonard Peikoff's book, Objectivism and the Philosophy of Ayn Rand. Stay tuned. All right, so let's wrap up our discussion of capitalism and dive right in with a summary. So our starting point is the fact that there is, as we've seen, a moral opposition to capitalism rooted in the fact that the ethics of sacrifice is at odds with the politics of individualism, freedom, and capitalism. But now deeper than that, it's that opposition to capitalism comes from bad epistemology, specifically from intrinsicism and subjectivism. And so Leonard gives us an illustration of the various ways that people respond to, you know, the objectivist argument against the claim that a free market, that capitalism leads to monopolies. And what we see is that they will often take the form of rejecting all of the essentials of a proper epistemology. So, for example, you'll offer certain definition, and it's that the definitions will be dismissed as arbitrary, which is the subjectivist view, or it will be, no, my authorities say something different, which is the intrinsicist view. Or if you appeal to principles, it's, no, we have to look at everything in a case-by-case basis. And so Leonard's conclusion is that people are often sincere in their opposition to capitalism in some sense, because they literally can't process a conceptual argument for capitalism. I mean, it's that they can process it metaphysically, that they're human beings and they have the potential to reason, but it's that in practice their methodology flies in the face of an objective methodology in every aspect, whether it's definitions and principles, hierarchy, context, integration. It's that they're not functioning objectively, and therefore they can't follow and can't embrace an objective argument. And so Leonard then goes on to show that it's bad epistemology behind all of the countless objections to capitalism, whether it's capitalism leads to depressions or child labor or racism, adulterated food and drugs, pollution, war, pornography. And indeed, he points out that the attacks on capitalism are often contradictory. They cancel each other out. So you have capitalism creates monopolies, and it's the system of cutthroat competition. And whenever you say that you're for capitalism, it's that people invent all kinds of arbitrary fantasies, like what if all doctors started charging $1 million for an appendectomy? What if no one helps the helpless? And yet nobody asks, what if under socialism, you know, a leader turns into a monster, which is something that actually does happen all the time and is not just kind of a speculative fantasy. And so there's a bad epistemology going on, and it's all pushing it in the anti-capitalist direction. And here's how Leonard puts the basic issue or the basic causality of this. He says, irrationalism leads the intellectuals to discard the possibility of independence, of the reality orientation, in favor of altruism, which leads them to conclude that capitalism is evil. Thereafter, however scandalously they drop context, rewrite history, or contradict themselves, they feel no shame. For so long as they are anti-capitalist, they feel noble. Their epistemology, in short, permits them to manipulate the data as they choose, to reach any conclusions they like in regard to any matter of fact, and their ethics programs them to reach only statist conclusions. And so we have all these intellectuals who are anti-capitalism, which means that there's no one able to provide humanity with a proper evaluation of the facts of capitalism. And that's crucial, we get, because it's the facts don't speak for themselves. People can look around and see good things like prosperity, but they won't see why freedom is essential to prosperity, what freedom even is, or how to answer all the arguments against it. And it's the same on the negative. They can see all the destruction caused by socialism, but it's like, well, I keep hearing that that's not real socialism. And then they can also look around and see there's all kinds of problems today, and people keep blaming that on capitalism. So the only way we can get capitalism is with better philosophy, not only in ethics, but the precondition of a rational ethics, a proper metaphysics and epistemology, or if we want to put it, a real understanding of objectivity. So I want to talk about why people oppose capitalism. And for Ayn Rand, there's a necessary division of labor in intellectual issues. That is, because the rest of us have things to do to earn a living and other areas of life to focus on, we rely on intellectuals to understand and explain where we are, how we got here, and where we should go. And so to understand why we're moving away from capitalism, it's fundamentally going to be explained by intellectuals. And so then the question is, well, why is it that intellectuals oppose capitalism? And ultimately here, Ayn Rand thinks that there's also another division of labor between intellectuals, where the prime movers are philosophers and that they're setting the basic frameworks that are shaping every other intellectual field. And so when philosophy following Kant turned anti-reason, anti-individualist, anti-freedom, then our long-range course was essentially set, absent a change in philosophy. And what Leonard is highlighting, I think, is how it's fundamentally the turn away from reason that explains the turn away from capitalism. It's the inability of intellectuals to think conceptually that explains at the deepest level why we're abandoning freedom, why they oppose capitalism. But the story is actually quite complicated, or at least the story that Ayn Rand gives for this is quite complicated. So she discusses this kind of process of intellectuals turning against capitalism and how that leads to the destruction of freedom in many, many places. But I would name, three that are probably the most important. And that is the intro piece for The New Intellectual, Faith and Force Destroyers of the Modern World, which is in Philosophy Who Needs It, and The Intellectual Bankruptcy of Our Age, which is reprinted in Voice of Reason. And what you get in kind of rough sketch is that since the Renaissance, philosophers had increasingly become pro-reason, pro-man, pro-this earth, pro-individual, pro-freedom. But they were unable to fully articulate and defend a pro-reason, pro-individual philosophy. And in particular, they were unable or unwilling to challenge the morality of sacrifice. Had they been able to develop a rational, non-sacrificial code of morality, then ultimately, Rand seems to think, mysticism would have died out and men would have eventually worked out a proper philosophic foundation, a proper metaphysics and epistemology, but that's not what happened. What did happen was that as Western civilization was finally coming to it into its own during the Enlightenment, you had this lethal contradiction of reason, which the Enlightenment embraced, and altruism, which the Enlightenment did not reject. And so Kant comes along then and says, well, look, this attempt to put everything in reason in charge of everything has failed. If you try to use reason to answer the most important questions about reality, like does God exist? What's the basic nature of the universe? Does man have free will? You end up in hopeless contradictions. And so reason can't even tell us about reality as it really is. It can only help us understand this kind of world of appearances. And as for morality then, reason definitely cannot ground morality. Morality depends ultimately on obeying orders from another dimension, from the really real reality that we can't access through our minds. And those orders have nothing to do with your self-interest. And indeed, if you're acting for the sake of your self-interest, nothing you do, even if it's like otherwise commanded by morality, is of moral worth. And so that becomes the basic framework that's used to evaluate capitalism as it emerges in the 19th century. And for reasons that we've talked about, if you view self-sacrifice as moral, then you can't see the system that unleashes selfishness, that rewards selfishness, as moral. And so what you end up with is you have a bunch of intellectuals who've embraced irrationalism of one form or another and who think selfishness is evil. And so they're willing to twist themselves into knots, knowing that as long as they're attacking capitalism and defending some form of collectivism, some form of statism, that they're in the right. And so that's kind of what explains the reason why they oppose capitalism and why we're moving in that direction. And then it also indicates the solution, which is that if you have a proper philosophy and intellectuals in every field who are using that framework to understand where we are, how we got here, and where we're going or where we should go, that's what's required to transform a nation or indeed the world in a better direction. And so ultimately, Ayn Rand has a lot more to say about the philosophic and indeed the psychological reasons that led to capitalism's destruction. But what I want to really just highlight here is that she thinks the blame goes to the philosophers and that she sees an intimate connection between the role of epistemology and ethics in leading us to oppose capitalism. So I thought it might be fun to go through some of the attacks on capitalism that Leonard raised and just give my like quick responses to them. And so let's start with this. Capitalism leads to monopolies. And my answer is, capitalism leads to the best firms succeeding so long as they remain the best. Socialism's answer is to monopolize everything and never let any new idea get tried unless you get an entire bureaucracy to sign off. What about capitalism leads to depressions? Well, it's full capitalism leads to full-time prosperity, full socialism leads to full-time depressions, and it's half-assed socialism that's caused the handful of depressions that we've enjoyed in mixed economies. What about capitalism leads to child labor? Well, capitalism inherited child labor and eliminated child labor. Like, what do you think children were doing in 1600? They were farming and dying. Capitalism was what made us rich enough to send kids to school. Or capitalism leads to adulterated food and drugs. Well, socialism leads to zero food and drugs. Capitalism not only leads to an abundance of food and drugs, but greedy capitalists usually don't want to go out of business, so they work really hard to keep quality high. And if they're negligent or fraudulent, a capitalist government will punish them. Or capitalism leads to pollution. It's poverty that leads to pollution, and capitalism leads to prosperity and technology, which gives us the luxury to worry about clean air, clean water. The dirtiest environments are in the least free countries. What about capitalism leads to the poor getting poorer? Well, socialism leads to everybody getting poorer except the rulers. Capitalism has made our poor rich by world standards, and we could do much better if we were more free. So one tip for defending capitalism, which I think should have come through in just those small little examples, is that you never want to defend capitalism in a vacuum. Like, what usually happens is you say, I'm for laissez-faire capitalism. Then the other person just hurls a whole bunch of objections that you try to answer in a vacuum. But if you answer attacks on your system without forcing the people throwing the attacks to commit to a positive of their own, then you lose. Because what it amounts to is that you have to prove that capitalism is perfect rather than that capitalism is superior. And in a sense, it is perfect. That is, if you have rational standards of perfection, then a system that protects individual rights is a perfect system. But rather, what's encouraged by not having alternatives on the table and the other side having to defend those alternatives is that what you're doing is you're not measuring capitalism by a rational standard of perfection. You're measuring it by a mystical standard of perfection where, like, everybody has infinity of everything and nothing bad ever happens and there's no challenges and every problem is automatically solved. So it's that you have to always be contrasting capitalism with the alternatives that are on the table. But here's the thing. Even if you do that in a given answer, you can't persuade people of capitalism by defending it against attacks. Like, part of what Leonard is arguing here is that the anti-capitalist mentality can invent infinity new attacks on capitalism because it's not tied to reason. It's basically like deuces wild. As long as they're attacking capitalism and as long as they're defending statism, like, they're totally willing to like go down that journey and go down that road. Does that mean, therefore, well, it's hopeless? And no, because what has to happen is that people have to adopt a better framework. But people don't adopt or even consider a new framework just because, oh, hey, Don had snappy answers to every objection I could come up with. So it's not that you have to have that you prove your framework by answering infinite objections. Rather, it's that if you have something that's profoundly compelling and explanatory about your framework, that will intrigue people enough to entertain it, and that there becomes a certain point at which they endorse it. And if you just think about people's reaction to Atlas Shrugged, it's, oh my God, I've heard these arguments my whole life, and there's another way of thinking about them. And it's a way that leads to, you know, Dagny and Galt and Francisco and Galt's Gulch. And it's only then they'll want to know sincerely, not just hurling objections, but wondering, what about all these objections I've heard about capitalism? And the point is that you don't need Atlas Shrugged in order to accomplish that, in order for them to get to think, here's a framework that's really powerful and I want to learn more about it and I think it's really promising. So one way you can do it is just on a specific issue. And this is what Alex Epstein does in The Moral Case for Fossil Fuels. It's what I try to do in Roosevelt Care, How Social Security is Sabotaging the Land of Self-Reliance. You can do it through nonfiction, like broad nonfiction narratives, such as Yaron and I do with Free Market Revolution and Equals Unfair. The point about these, though, is that they're explicitly discussing frameworks and showing the weakness of the wrong framework, its inability to explain where we are, how we got here, and where we should go. And by having your own framework that can explain those things. And so it's the strength of your framework comes from how much it can really explain and integrate for people. And another way to put that is clarify for people. And then the positive ideal that it's driving towards. And so those are the sorts of ingredients that then, if you can give people the idea that you have a powerful framework of that sort and get them excited about it, and then it's within that context that being able to answer, you know, a lot of these objections becomes really useful and really powerful. And so I encourage people to see other work I've done in this, certainly my books and all the rest of the stuff on the YouTube page. That's it for this video. That's it for capitalism. And we are on to the final chapter of Objectivism, the Philosophy of Ayn Rand. So subscribe to the YouTube channel. And as always, the best way to stay in contact is to go to donswriting.com and sign up for the newsletter. Talk next time.